Welcome to another edition of this podcast, and I'm delighted to say that my guest today is Jacques Po, who is the author of Our Poisoned Land, Living in the Shadows of Zuma's Keepers. And this is a book that is a sequel to the best-selling The President's Keepers. That book was the fastest-selling book in South African book history, literally selling like amagwinya at a taxi rank. Tens of thousands in the first week alone. And I think this one is going to do just as well. You're listening to Eusebius on Times Live. That's this latest podcast on Times Live. And it's me, Eusebius McKaiser, exploring the major issues of the week. That means you're going to hear a lot of law, politics, and ethics, how they intersect and how important these stories are in the life of all South Africans.
When people saw
their children must know these are sellouts.
They put saliva on the paper.
Mr. Julius Malema whispered and said, sing it, sing it.
And then they shared that Zola.
No, I'm not going to apologize.
Can I have my iPad, please? So they stole it.
Jacques, congratulations on yet another success, an important book, and thank you so much for agreeing to an interview.
Good afternoon.
So I want to start maybe in a slightly strange place. There's so much we can go into. We're going to need a couple of interviews to do your work justice. I was a little bit annoyed, I said so in a written review, by the excerpt that was chosen. The excerpt focused on drunk EFF parties in the middle of Sandton, not far from where I am currently. Condoms that are left behind, bottles of Moet that are burst because they forget to take them out and drink them. And this all sponsored by a dodgy cigarette baron. And the reason I was annoyed is that I thought that it banalizes your work. This is such an important work, and we'll talk about why and how, that the EFF's legal threats and the response to that excerpt is good for the book sales. Your publishers must be happy in that sense, but there's always that weird trade-off between talkability and doing the heart of the book justice. And I think that there's so much in this book. Before we get to the EFF on page 351 for the first time, that the excerpt was a little bit double-edged, good for commercialism, but it lent you to weird, unnecessary criticism. Like a gentleman that stopped me, a story I tell in the print review, and said to me, Eusebius, what do you make of Jacques' excerpt? Do you think the guy thinks that us black people should not use condoms? Why is it a bad thing? And why are we not entitled to partying? What say you?
Well, you know, I've said from the word go that I don't want this book to be known as the book that Julius Malema doesn't want you to read. Because it's ultimately a book about how my motherland or my homeland has been poisoned by the likes of Zuma and the aftermath of state capture. You know, I had very little say in what excerpts was going to be chosen. I mean, you hand the book to a variety of editors and book editors, and they choose, and that's the juicy part. You know, you've just mentioned the question of used condoms and whatever. There's so much more in the affidavits that I have about the events playing itself off in Adriano Mazzotti's apartment in Sandton. And I battled with it for some time because it's far more salacious than what I published in the end. Is in South Africa, we don't have a lot of time for writers or journalists speaking into the sexual affairs of our public officers. But you know, we quote from the affidavits. It is in the affidavits. I think it is to a certain extent. It is necessary when you look at someone like Julius Malema. This is a man who openly says that he wants to be president one day and that he is going to be president one day. And I think there is a question of morality, and that is that, and that he should also be judged by an affair like this.
Okay, I want to tell you what I think as a reader the heart of the book is, and then I want you to tell me, A, what you think of that, and B, how that compares to authorial intent. I think that this book is ultimately a devastating account of the moral, constitutional, and material near collapse of the African-led state in post-apartheid South Africa. The chapters leading up to the EFF's cameo appearance, only midway through, between 300 and 400 pages, is fundamentally, for those who haven't yet picked up the book, about PRASA, the Hawks, crime intelligence, the SAPs, the NPA. And if it stopped there, and it was a book that is only 350 pages in length, it would still be a good book. And I read this book as another and an important contribution to the literature on state capture. What do you think of that? And what was your intention for how it should fit in?
I agree with you. You know, I first of all, I didn't intend to write a follow-up of The President's Keepers. And primarily because I think when you had so much success with a book, you just leave it alone. Don't try and mess up its legacy. So I started working on this book about 2 years ago. As I said, I didn't intend to write a follow up. What happened is that when President Ramaphosa came to power in February 2018, he did very well for the first year of his presidency. At least as far as the law enforcement agencies are concerned. You know, he got rid of people like Tom Oyani. The High Court helped him to get rid of Sean Abrams. He appointed new people, appointed a new head of the Hawks, a new commissioner of SARS, a new national director of public prosecutions. So for the first year of his presidency, there was hope that things were going to change. You know, I said with The President's Keepers that Jacob Zuma brought us to the brink of becoming a mafia or a criminal state. And I said afterwards that Ramaphosa pulled us back. Unfortunately, we once again where we were at the end of the Zuma administration. And I think the biggest failure of Ramaphosa has been the fact that he's put the unity of his party before the well-being of the country. And that is why we are where we are. We seem to have made very little progress in so many aspects that I described in my book. Yes, there's been some...
John, can I ask you at this point? I absolutely agree. And that's how I end my written review. I make the point there to cheat a little bit on my reading followers by sharing with my listeners who don't like reading as much what the final sentences are, that despite the EFF leadership's response to the book, actually they should have shut up, because the careful reader will realize that the person who comes out worse for wear is not Julius, but actually Ramaphosa, because the book ultimately is an indictment of the new dawn and shows the continuities are many more than the discontinuities between the ANC led by his predecessor and the one led by himself. I held back some of the juice because you and I as authors want readers to go and buy the book, but let's give them a taste of the evidence in support of this claim. And maybe I can prompt you in two ways. Tell my listeners of examples of dodgy Zuma keepers that Ramaphosa didn't have the backbone to get rid of and turned into ambassadors? And secondly, why someone like Tshele should have been dealt with very differently by Ramaphosa if he was really committed to constitutionalism?
Right, let's start with Tshele. I think many people forget that Tshele was Jacob Zuma's first commissioner of police. Zuma came to power in May 2009 and he appointed Bheki Tshele, who was then an avid Zuma supporter, as his commissioner of police. And remember that Tshele was quite quite liked for his expressions about shoot to kill and police must shoot first and whatever. Anyway, he left in disgrace after the public protector issued two findings against him as far as the police headquarters scandal is concerned. I'm not going to go into it. Then Bekele disappeared into obscurity, just to be appointed a few years later by Jacob Zuma as his deputy minister of agriculture and fisheries, of all things. Anyway, eventually Bekele got onto the Ramaphosa wagon and he became our commissioner of police. Bekele has got no moral authority to be in cabinet, not after the public protector made two damning findings against him. I then discovered that there was actually a Hawks investigation against Kele, that because the public protector, one of her findings was that the police should investigate the relationship between Rushabangu and Bekele. And we all know that, you know, her findings are binding. So the Hawks started an investigation against Bekele and it completely disappeared. I then discovered that the Hawks emptied the docket. There is nothing left in that docket. Initially, they asked for they subpoenaed the bank records and the telephone records of both Shibangu and Kele. It all disappeared. The ID then resuscitated the investigation. The investigating director resuscitated the investigation. That's where my book stopped. In the meantime, I've discovered that the ID then decided that Advocate Johnson decided that this is not a case for the ID because the ID concentrates on state capture cases. The case is now back with the Hawks. So the Hawks is now supposed to investigate their own political head. It's never going to work. I also alluded in my book about the very peculiar relationship between Bekele and a convicted drug dealer in KwaZulu-Natal by the name of Timothy Marimutu, and I'm not going to go into detail with that. You know, one of the heroes of state capture was Robert McBride, who was then the head of IPED, the police watchdog. Bekele played a definite and a very damning role to get rid of Robert McBride to make sure that he was not going to be that his contract would not be renewed. We all know about the July 2021 unrest in KwaZulu-Natal and Gauteng when Bekele and the whole police force stood by and they did absolutely nothing. I think Ramaphosa's greatest failure as far as law enforcement is concerned is not only Bekele, it's also the Commissioner of Police, Kehla Sithole. Here's a man who was appointed in the final days of the Zuma administration, and we know why Zuma appointed him, because he's ineffectual. Who's a man who's a former Homeland cop, comes from the homeland of Kwan Debele. He's got absolutely no academic qualifications. And you must remember that the Commissioner of Police is in many ways the number one public servant, the biggest state department with the biggest budget.
And might I add parenthetically, quoting you, by his own admission, not managing to actually meet the threshold requirements.
Yes, he admitted that during the Human Rights Commission hearings when he was cross-examined about his qualifications. It took Cyril Ramaphosa 4 years to get rid of Kehla Sithole, despite the fact, and it's once again, it's very complicated, that Sithole is implicated in an attempt to buy a grabber that cost only 7 or 8 million rand to buy it for 45 million rand, and the bulk of the money would have gone for Nkosazana Dlamini Zuma during the 2007 ANC elective conference at Nasrec. It took Cyril Ramaphosa 4 years to get rid of Kehla Sithole. And when he finally got rid of Kehla Sithole, he tapped him on the shoulder and he said to him, "You go, full pension rights. You know, it's as though you retired early." Mm. You talk about people who become ambassadors. There's a string of state security agency failed director generals who became
and former ministers, yes, like Siyabonga.
Yeah, that became ambassadors. Yeah, Siyabonga Gwele implicated in stopping an investigation against the Guptas at the State Security Agency. And you can't get much worse than that, face it. Stopped an investigation against the Guptas at the State Security Agency. He's our ambassador in China today. You know, there are failed divisional commissioners of crime intelligence who are ambassadors today. And it's just as though there has the rule of law for many people did not apply or is not applying during the Ramaphosa administration.
So, Jacques, for me, there are two conclusions. And the first for my listeners is that detail matters. And what Jacques has done, which I think is one of the upsides of your book, is you've done the legwork for those of us who don't have the time or the skill or the inclination by trawling the archives, re-inscribing with acknowledgement, which is intellectually important, the work of our colleagues, your Paulie van Lakes, Peter Louis Meiberg, the whistleblowers, the research institutions, civil society organizations. Detail matters, and we often forget that when we get state capture fatigue. But secondly, more to the immediate point, that in the best case scenario, Jacques, and I know you don't think of yourself as a political analyst, but I think this book is also good political analysis. In the best case scenario, a Ramaphosa defender will say, as my old friend Karima used to say when her and I fought about these things in a spirited way, that the ANC is complex and you've got to keep your enemies closer. But Mr. Ramaphosa can't hang on to that defense because he seems to be making these choices at the expense of the constitutional edifice.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, once again, I'm not a political analyst, but it's incomprehensible that people like Lindiwe Sisulu, Beki Kele, there's a host of others, that they are still in cabinet. We know that Beki Kele is only in cabinet because he is Cyril Ramaphosa's most avid supporter in KwaZulu-Natal. Ramaphosa needs it. The same for somebody like Gwedi Montage. You know, and in this book, I had to make a choice about what state-owned enterprise I'm going to write about, because you can't write about Transnet and Enel. Oh, and Eskom and Prasa.
Yeah, if you do a good enough job with one, it becomes exemplary. Why did you choose Prasa?
You know, because number one, there's the Guptas are not involved in Prasa. These are homegrown South Africans like me and you that looted the passenger rail agency of South Africa. And I think what was fascinating about Prasa for me is when I started digging about what happened to the Prasa case, because it was already handed to the Hawks in 2015. A storeroom full of evidence was handed to the Hawks in 2015 by Popo Molefe. That's the other reason why I chose Prasa, is because Popo Molefe is a real hero of state capture, a deployed ANC cadre that stood up against the party and stood up against the president. And that's why I chose Prasa. It's sort of homegrown South Africans. There's a euro, and there are damning evidence about how the Hawks messed up the case. And what is very, very, very telling in the Prasa case, and somehow everybody missed this because there was so much at the State Capture Commission, was that during the hearings, Judge Zondo said to the Hawks, "I want to know what happened to the case." Godfrey Lebeya then handed him an affidavit. And the judge was absolutely scathing of Lebeya. And he basically said to Lebeya, "I do not buy your explanation. It is not true." That whole part was sort of missed in all the activity going on around the State Capture Commission. That's why I chose Prasa. I thought it's a very good example.
But besides that, Jacques, you also... The closest you came to a big criticism of the judge is, and you almost did it parenthetically, it was that understated, that you said you disagree with the idea that there should be a Prosa investigation. What is already known and from previous reports in the public space is more than enough. We need to get on with the business of readying material for trial and seeing these folks in the docks yet and to be imprisoned. And this idea of, you know, a key recommendation being another inquiry is complete BS, that what we have available already is more than sufficient. It's now about the political will to do constitutional duty as a prosecutor and get on with it.
Absolutely. I mean, I fundamentally disagree with Judge Zondo, and I absolutely admired him for the work he had done. But we don't need another commission. We need prosecutions, and the evidence is there. And, you know, the looters of Prasa are living very comfortably off their loot. You know, somebody like Oshwal Mashaba, who's got, you know, a whole series of lodges and boutique hotels and whatever through the country. He's not even ashamed of the money he stole because he's named his lodge after himself, AM Lodge. So the evidence is there. I mean, this is like this is like low hanging fruit for the asset forfeiture unit. There's a lodge in Limpopo. Go and seize it.
Can you, in that vein, I'm going to bring this to a close. Only, I actually want to speak to you for hours, but let people go read it. We'll come back in a few months, and I know you're generous. We can engineer a session with. That's more live and people can even come into our conversation. But I was telling a driver on my way to Pretoria, infamously not driving myself, and I was going to do an event where I moderated at UNISA, and he was a very well-informed South African, and we invariably, when people recognize me, they want to talk politics. And we were both lamenting the state of the nation. And he, you know, he asked me how I think about how things are going. And I told him about your book and why the book's important. And I said to him, you know, Sipho, everything you've said so far, he was giving examples of things like kids drowning in a river because there's not a proper bridge, because there's a tender fraud and the bridge never gets constructed and someone gets a few million. I said to him, you know what, everything you've said is true, but South Africans don't actually know that things are 10 times worse than what they think is bad when they think things are bad. And I gave him examples of how in intelligence and in policing from your book, someone will, like the Mudluli Seven, have their entire family suddenly get ranks in the police in eThekwini, draw salaries, or the police are renting out their properties, even though they're not being used, and paying them for renting it out. And that if those stories were as garden variety as a story, like, let's say, for example, what happened to Michael Komape in 2015, who drowned in a pit latrine, South Africans would be even more anxious and angry, because the bigger numbers and the more brazen, large-scale killings, skullduggery, subversion of intelligence, it's actually worse than the examples that are the most well-known. So give me an example, whether it's this eThekwini one and our own Guptas, as you call it in one chapter, or the Bengluli wife and former wife, so that people can have a taste of just how brazen and even almost comical, if it weren't real, some of the looting patterns are.
Yeah, I mean, if you just go back to crime intelligence, for example, we all know what happened to crime intelligence under Richard Mdluli, who is in fact went to prison and is now facing another prison sentence. He appointed friends and cronies and families across South Africa as agents of crime intelligence. And I remember 10 years ago when I was a journalist at Media 24, at News 24, I used to write about this. I used to write about these characters. I used to write about Timmy Marimutu with his drug conviction that became an informer and got a Mercedes-Benz with a blue light and whatever. 10 of his family members were appointed as agents. And they were all appointed as agents to get close to Bekele. And over the years, these people absolutely looted the secret fund of the police. Absolutely nothing has happened to Timmy Marimutu or any of his family. In fact, when Peter Jacobs arrived at Crime Intelligence as the new head in 2018, he issued an order for these people to go back to work because some of them had never, ever reported for duty. He said to everyone, please, all of you, all of these secret agents appointed by Richard Medluli, can you all please report for duty? Nothing has happened to anyone. There are police generals sitting in Crime Intelligence that has had disciplinary charges against them for the past decade. Those disciplinary hearings have never gotten off the ground. In a storeroom in Crime Intelligence are 13 grabbers that were bought at a price of 113 million rand that could have had a major impact on the violence last year, the July 2021 violence. Becky Kele has never gotten the end user certificates for the police to use these grabbers. And I can go on and on and on. You know, it's a never ending story. And you know what? I'm not sure that it's going to improve in any way.
Third last question. The EFF should worry. The point that I'm making as a reviewer is simply that the book is not only about them, and actually they make a late appearance, and the careful reader should not be misdirected by the excerpt. But the reason they matter in chapter 21 is that you put them on trial against the anti-poor political narrative and campaign on which they got into parliament in the first place, and then drawing in part on the work of Paulie van Wyk, but also supplementing it with your own work, speaking to workers of the tobacco tycoon that is his friend, you then show that the evidence refutes this claim to being deeply committed to the interests of gardeners and domestic workers. Without giving too much away, give my listeners a sense of what you were testing for, so much so that this is the one chapter where you even found yourself traveling to Malawi to try and corroborate some claims.
Well, you know, the claims that were made by the person that I call Margaret, the housekeeper, and she was far more than a housekeeper. In fact, she's qualified as a receptionist and she has a diploma and whatever. It's a very clever and astute person. You know, as I said to you, I worked with her over a period of several years, in fact, before I decided to publish her allegations. And I traveled to Malawi to go and look for a chef that had worked for Mazzotti and had met Julius Malema and worked in the apartment. Of course, I had to corroborate what she said to me. You know, I let her sign an affidavit and I let her sign another affidavit a few months later. The Malawian chef signed a statement. But I think it's important that people realize that these allegations about the excesses of the EFF doesn't suddenly fall out of a tree. This has been coming for a very, very long time. You know, the fact that Julius Malema is a kept politician is not a revelation that I'm making. It was a revelation that we met already in what, 2011, 2012, with the On Point and Gwangwa allegations in the Limpopo province, for which he was criminally charged, and then the state dropped the charges. We all know about VBS Bank, where 1.89 billion rand, mostly coming from poor people and pensioners in the Limpopo province, was looted, 16 million rand in cash and loans of altogether 5 million rand, found its way to Brian Shivambu, who is Floyd Shivambu's brother, and from there he dispersed it to Julius Malema, the EFF, and Floyd Shivambu. You know, a very important question is raised here. And there's others. There's the Giani Water Project. There are other examples of handouts to Malema. It raises a very serious question. And I think this is a question we will have to answer in the weeks and months and years to come. Is the EFF a criminal enterprise? Or is it just a legitimate political organization. Because there's clear evidence that Malema and Chivambo have used the EFF to fill their coffers with ill-gotten money. So the allegations against Malema is not going to stop here. It's going to continue because it happens all the time. So I think to a certain
extent, by the way, before I ask the penultimate question, what is the answer you give yourself? Are they a bona fide political party or criminal enterprise?
I think at this point they're both. They are a legitimate political party. We can never get away from that. They've got, I think, 44 seats in parliament. They are a legitimate political party, and for many, many, many of their supporters, they are a legitimate political party, and they believe in the party. Listen, not everything that Julius Malema says is ridiculous or wrong. I mean, many things that he says is true. When he spoke about the land, much of what he's saying is true. But I think it's both. I think at this point I think that Malema and Chivambo are using the EFF to fill their coffers, and to a certain extent, it is a criminal enterprise.
Second last question. You were coy in one particular sentence early in the book that surprised me. To be fair on you, I haven't checked the bibliography reference around that chapter. Maybe the answer lurks there. As part of the money that is used for nefarious purposes by intelligence structures, various parts of the state for that matter, but you do focus most of the book on, for example, the broader question of state security agency doing the bidding for factions of the ANC. Along the way, you mentioned that includes the ensnaring of journalists who are then used in the service of certain political narratives that may favor this or that person vying for a position within the ANC. Which journalists have been paid?
I don't know. You know, this comes from allegations that has been made at, amongst others, the State Capture Commission. I don't have evidence of that. I do not.
Okay, because the statement was a declarative statement. Made me wonder whether you had names in your back pocket.
I've heard names, but I don't have enough evidence to publish it. You know, I've heard names. I don't know. I don't know if it's true.
Okay. So you're not going to have a Stefan moment with me?
No, I'm not going to.
And then the last question. I said to a friend of mine over lunch earlier today that I'm really glad that I read the author's note, because a part of me wondered whether your publishers were simply relying on the fact that you are a larger-than-life celebrity and successful journalist, and you will sell, or whether they had the ethics to actually force you consciously to reflect on the waterfront incident and the loss of credibility. And I think it was important for you to go there. Ethically and tactically, both. And you do so in the author's note. Don't give everything away, but I must ask you the question, and I can tell my listeners that Jacques deals with it. You can judge what you make of his response by buying the book and reading it. A lot of people, one person said to me on Facebook, who's got no EFF affiliation, doesn't care about the ANC, a very progressive academic, agreed with me that the EFF's legal threats are silly. It's simply good publicity for the book. And she agreed, but then she ended her wry agreement by saying, but by the way, didn't we cancel Jacques Paul? What do you say to someone who loves your body of work, but wonders about your epistemic authority in light of the Daily Maverick article?
Well, you know, as far as the author's note is concerned, I planned it initially as my prologue. I wanted to start with it. And the publisher said to me, no, you can't start with that. That's not very clever. We'll put it in the back of the book. I had to deal with it. It was a terrible moment in my life. I made a terrible mistake. And all I can say to people who criticize me for it, you know, read what I write about it. I fell very, very hard. I decided I'm going to get up again. I dealt with it as best as I could. went for therapy, started working again, and ultimately wrote this book. And I would like people to know that the event at the waterfront, as painful as it is, has not in any way influenced the way I do my work or the way I write or the way I research the topics that I write about.
Jacques, congratulations on this book. It's very important, and I hope reviewers and readers do it justice by reading it carefully and engaging the entire thematic range. I want to thank you for it. And I also, again, want to stress that I think that the obsessive reader who knows a lot about politics will find some of it familiar, but I think everyone, including the expert, will find something new and nuanced about it. And in your acknowledgements section, you also correctly point to a non-exhaustive list of our colleagues in the media and amongst the authors in the country who have also contributed to this overall body of work. But I think the way you synthesize it is really useful, and that's in the worst case scenario, still a good case scenario. And I think many will also agree that some of the chapters are actually substantial and not just a mere synthesis. Thanks so much for coming on the platform.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.